Welcome to the Cogit Asia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on Asia. I'm Colm Quinn. We'll start as we usually do with the week's news. Shocking video of a TransAsia Airways plane crash in Taipei drew media attention worldwide this week when a plane crashed into the Keelung River shortly after takeoff, killing the majority on board. Taiwan's search for survivors continued into Friday. In the South China Sea, the Philippines accused a Chinese Coast Guard vessel of ramming three fishing boats near the disputed Scarborough Shoal. The Chinese Foreign Ministry defended the actions of the vessel and argued it was merely a bumping by a dinghy, urging Manila to better indoctrinate its fishing crews. In Korea, President Park Geun-hye's approval rating fell to its lowest level since she took office in early 2013. Madam Park announced plans to reshuffle her cabinet amid controversy over a tax settlement, a health insurance law, and personnel decisions. Korea's National Assembly finalized plans for confirmation hearings starting February 9th to review new Prime Minister nominee Lee Won-koo's candidacy. Park's previous appointee agreed to resign after the Sewol ferry sinking in April 2014. In India, Delhi will hold Legislative Assembly elections on February 7th. 70 districts in the capital will vote, with the party winning a majority of seats, placing Delhi's chief minister. Working-level talks on the Trans-Pacific Partnership between the US and Japan on autos and agricultural market access ended on Tuesday, with negotiators reporting some positive progress made, but with a few hurdles remaining. News circulated this week that Japan is prepared to meet the United States halfway on beef and pork import tariffs on U.S. agricultural products. The next working talks between U.S. and Japan will take place later this month. The People's Bank of China cut bank's reserve requirement ratio 50 basis points on February 5th and lowered it even further for banks targeting lending towards small and medium enterprises and agricultural concerns. The decision comes as Chinese capital outflows in the fourth quarter of 2014 had their largest surge since 1998, driven by growing expectations of yuan depreciation and increasing outbound investment from Chinese companies. The PBOC cut was part of a broad easing trend underway across the region. And that's the news. We turn now to Bonnie Glaser, senior advisor with the Freeman Chair in China Studies, to discuss the state of US-China military-to-military ties.
Well, we had news this week that the US-China dialogues were going to be put on hold. How does that sit with you? What was your reaction to that?
Well, US-China military exchanges have been going quite well, and there is a very active agenda of exchanges for 2015. So I don't think that the story is correct that the United States will not consider new military exchanges with China. There will likely be a very high-level visit by one of the vice chairmen of the Central Military Commission from China to the United States this year. Just this week, there are defense policy coordination talks. We call them the DPCTs. And following that, several months down the road, will likely be the annual defense consultative talks. There are lots of things that are taking place. The two most recent examples of progress in the U.S.-China military relationship are the two, what we call MOUs, Memoranda of Understanding, on confidence-building measures between the United States and China. And those were signed when President Obama was in Beijing for the summit right after the APEC meeting. And, of course, he met with Xi Jinping. And these two MOUs are really significant because one is essentially trying to agree on rules of the road at sea between surface naval vessels so that when they encounter each other at sea, they will communicate with each other in a predictable way. And this MOU relies on already existing international agreements and understandings. So there's no reinventing the wheel. This is not a unique bilateral set of arrangements between the U.S. and China. But it will make accidents less likely. And if there were to be an accident, it would make escalation less likely. And so this is really the first time that the United States and China have signed such an agreement to lower the potential for accident and escalation in waters that are close to China, where the United States operates regularly conducting surveillance in China's 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone. And the Chinese regularly try to scramble their aircraft or to use their ships in ways that they want to push the United States away from China's shores. We've been talking about these ideas of creating rules of the road at sea, if you will, since 1998, and have really made very little progress. So this is really the first. And then the second MOU is on notifying each other about major military activities. This is voluntary, and it is also confidential. So the two sides may agree at some point to make public what is being notified, and the notifications do not have to be in advance, so there's a lot of flexibility there. But the idea really is to notify each other about new policy changes. China is about to release its defense white paper. That will come out probably in April. And this is published every 2 years, so China will probably notify the United States in advance. And there also is likely to be notifications for major military exercises that take place. But it's an important forward, I think, step in the relationship.
So how confident are you in these confidence-building measures? You know, is this a creation of is it a red phone style system? Do you think that these new measures will work?
Well, we already have hotlines with the Chinese, and there were instances such as in 2001 when there was, in fact, a collision between a U.S. surveillance plane and a Chinese fighter jet, where the Chinese did not pick up the hotline. They didn't answer the red phone when many people in the U.S. government and military tried to reach them. But this is a little different because it's really putting in place an agreement on how to operate at sea so you avoid the accident, you communicate with each other in the operational way, not just between your presidents or between your secretaries of defense. I think that the Chinese have come to understand that an accident, not only between the U.S. and China, but potentially between China and Japan, would be very dangerous, hard to control, would severely damage political relationships. It could incite nationalism within China that would be very difficult to control. And I think Xi Jinping truly recognizes that. So I have a high degree of confidence that the Chinese at the very highest levels are trying to ensure that there will not be an accident. What I have less confidence about is whether the individual operators, the pilots or the commanders of the ships, will not on occasion try to behave in somewhat aggressive, cowboyish ways. And that's when accidents happen.
Yeah, we saw that incident of the airman buzzing another American plane, I think earlier in the year. I wanted to talk about a story that came out this week also from China, rumors of a second aircraft carrier being built. Whether this is true or not, whether this is farther along or not, is this something that allies in the region or the U.S. need to be worried about?
Well, China now has one aircraft carrier, which it purchased from Ukraine and then refitted. And there are many rumors that China is now developing an indigenous aircraft carrier, and there could be two or more that are under construction. There's no evidence yet as to how many there will be what the length of the program is. But the one that has been deployed is still not fully operational and will take some time to really be able to operate with a full contingent of aircraft and pilots. They're still training their aviators to be able to land on carriers. This is obviously extremely challenging, not only in daytime, but of course even more difficult in nighttime. So this is a decades-long project of developing these capabilities. I am fairly certain that China will in fact, produce more aircraft carriers. The one that they have has a ski jump as opposed to a catapult. Now, the difference is how much weight that when you take off, if you don't have a catapult, that and if you're fully fueled, then the payload you can carry has to be relatively lighter. So if you have a catapult, you can carry larger weapons and probably more fuel. So China's carrier, the Liaoning, that it currently has deployed, is a ski jump. And that provides limited power projection capability, limited ability of it to loiter, even if it is if the planes fly far from the carrier, they have to come back. And so I think countries, the smaller countries in the region, are nervous. This is a new capability. They're only used to American aircraft carriers sailing around. But for the United States, I don't think we see this as much of a challenge. Of course, in wartime, I think it would be very vulnerable. And China has to develop the capability to defend the aircraft carrier as well. But if China has many more of these, yes, it will create a great deal of anxiety in the region, particularly in the South China Sea, where China regularly uses law enforcement ships to intimidate its neighbors. It was just a story yesterday about how the Chinese law enforcement ships were ramming three Philippine vessels around the Scarborough Shoal. These are fishing vessels, trying to push them out of the shoal. This is an area where the Philippines and China had a standoff in 2012. The Chinese won. They occupy the shoal. But it's the expansion in general of China's capabilities in naval and air force, that will, particularly those that will enable China to have more power projection, I think will be viewed as very threatening by the region. And the statements by China's defense ministry spokesman, which seem to be very carefully crafted, suggest that they are certainly not denying that they are building additional aircraft carriers. So I think it's simply a question of when. Since it is their first indigenous carrier program, I think it's going to take some time.
Annie Glaser, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was Bonnie Glaser. And now to our leaderboard. This week, we profile Eric Chu. Chu is the newly elected chairman of the Kuomintang KMT party in Taiwan, an office he assumed in January 2015 after president and former KMT chairman Ma Ying-jeou announced his resignation following a humiliating rout by the opposition Democratic Progressive Party in November 2014's local elections. Chu is also the mayor of New Taipei City, Taiwan's largest municipality, a position he first won in 2010 and just barely retained in last November's elections. Chu faces the challenge of restoring the KMT's image, which some believe is sacrificing Taiwan's freedom by cozying up to the mainland, which in turn does not benefit ordinary Taiwanese. At the same time, Chu must also sufficiently convince Beijing that he does not intend to roll back the economic links established during Ma's presidency. To start, Chu has focused on domestic concerns, including reducing income inequality and investigating whether a large portion of the KMT's wealth was ill-gotten, two of the biggest opposition attack points. At 53, Chu is over a decade younger than President Ma, positioning him well to present a more energetic image in upcoming presidential elections in 2016. For now, however, expect the top priority of Chu's to be helping the KMT re-emerge as a leaner and humbler party. Now we turn to Dr. Zachary Abuza to discuss the recent Philippine police raid that turned into an extended firefight in Mindanao. Dr. Abuza is the principal of Southeast Asia Analytics and writes on Southeast Asian politics and security issues. He's a frequent contributor to Cogitasia and is currently working on a book covering the peace processes in Aceh, Mindanao, and southern Thailand. My colleague and Cogitasia editor Jeff Bean caught up with Dr. Abuza to discuss his post on the raid, the MILF's response, and the fallout for the Philippines peace process.
January 25th, Philippine police forces began a raid on a compound in Mindanao. The compound is reportedly in possession of a splinter group of the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. The raid resulted in an extended firefight with many casualties. What was the police target, and do we know if they achieved their mission?
The target was a Malaysian suspected of being a member of Jemaah Islamiyah, Zulkifli bin Hur, better known as Marwan. He has been in the Philippines for over a decade teaching bomb making to various groups. He's spent time with the MILF, the Abu Sayyaf, and more recently a splinter group of the MILF, the Bangs Moro Islamic Freedom Front, or the BIF. He has a $5 million bounty and is on the FBI's most wanted list. Today, the FBI announced that DNA testing confirmed that he was killed. His brother has been in U.S. custody since 2007.
Over the last year, as you wrote in your post for us last week, we've seen a distinct absence of armed conflict. If you know, as folks are tracking this, they'll notice that over the last year, there hasn't been a significant amount of armed conflict between the Philippine government and the MILF because of the peace process. But what are the implications of this renewed violence for the peace process? And has President Aquino said anything in light of the raid and the fallout of it?
This was an enormous setback for the peace process, and it was the worst violence since 2010. I could not have scripted something that would have had a worse impact on the peace process. And let me give you a little background on this. In October 2012, the two sides signed something called the Framework Agreement, which created the roadmap for peace. The comprehensive agreement was concluded in March 2014 after four annexes were also negotiated, and these were on governance, wealth sharing, the maritime demarcation, disarmament, etc. Then last year, after a tumultuous 6 months, the Bangs Moro Basic Law, which is the implementing legislation that would create this legal autonomous zone, was finally concluded in September 2014. And since then, it's been deliberated in Congress. A vote was expected in March or April this year, but that seems a lot less likely right now. Before the firefight, the passage of the bill was almost certain. Majority of the Senate actually sponsored the bill. But since the incident, many congressmen and senators have either withdrawn their support for the bill or have called for much more deliberation, especially on the issue of arms decommissioning. Now, this attack has put President Aquino in a very hard spot. He has staked much of his reputation on the peace process. He has called the MILF's own inquiry into the incident as insufficient. Yet he has resisted hardliners in the police and military, as well as in Congress, who really want retribution. He remains committed to the peace process, and in his eulogy to the slain 44 police, he, you know, reiterated his commitment to the peace process. But it's going to be a lot harder for Congress to support the Bangs Moro Basic Law unless the MILF really comes clean on their relationship with the BIF and turn over the weapons that they seized. The Philippine government has demanded that the MILF turn over their 13 men involved in the encounter. And the Department of Justice yesterday announced that they are filing criminal charges against these individuals. The MILF is unlikely to acquiesce to this demand when they feel that they were acting in self-defense.
Who are the BIF, and what is their relationship with the MILF? We know they're a splinter group, and how does this this incident affect the potential both for disarmament as part of the peace process, but also what do you see as the key indicators for the relationship between the BIF and the MILF moving forward?
The BIF is comprised of former members of the MILF who started to disobey the leadership following the failure of a draft peace agreement in 2007. They formally broke away from the MILF in 2010 because of the peace process. They were angered that the MILF accepted an autonomy agreement. And if you look at the 1996 accord with the Moro National Liberation Front, you know, autonomy doesn't have a great track record in the Philippines. But more importantly, that this is operates in the same area as the MILF. They're bound by kinship and clan ties, which run very deep in that part of the world. Now, the MILF may not always agree with the BIF, and they have skirmished from time to time, but that's usually over revolutionary taxation. But, you know, at the end of the day, they're blood relatives. And the MILF is not going to turn on them without a real reason. They are also an insurance policy for the MILF. They serve as a reminder to the Philippines of the cost of renewed violence should the peace process fail. And that's precisely why the police didn't inform the MILF that they were conducting a raid in their territory. As they were supposed to do under the 1997 ceasefire agreement. The head of the Special Action Forces who led the raid came out and said very clearly, we don't trust them, and they really don't. Now, since the incident on January 28th, the two peace panels met in Kuala Lumpur, and they signed a protocol on disarmament, but this incident will make the disarming of the MILF all the harder. They have very legitimate concerns that if they are unarmed, then the government can act with impunity and violate their sovereignty at will. On the Philippine side, the urgency and the demand for MILF disarmament as a precondition for any support of the Bangsamoro Basic Law is only going to grow.
You mentioned the likely continuing relationship between the BIF and the MILF. On the Philippine government side, was there any fallout as a result of the raid? As you mentioned, over 40 police commandos were wounded in the raid. And from reports that we've seen to this point, the army was not called in to participate. So what is the relationship between the Philippine National Police and the Philippine Army, and how do you see that playing out going forward as it relates to counterinsurgency and counterterrorism operations in the Philippines?
As you said, 44 Special Action Forces were killed and 16 were wounded. So it was the single greatest loss of security force personnel in a very long time. It's impossible in any political system for there not to be political fallout from such a tragedy. There are harsh critics of the president who are angry that he has prioritized the peace process rather than standing by his men. Others have been infuriated that he has dodged responsibility for the assault and said, you know, he's passing the buck. At the same time, you also have leftists and nationalists who are trying to scapegoat the United States for pushing the Philippine security forces into conducting such a risky raid. Now, as you said, there is some very bad blood between the police and the army over this incident. The police carried out the raid without informing the army or the MILF or the ceasefire commission. So when the military did show up, they were quite late. The battle had been going on for several hours already, and they never deployed their light tanks or used any air cover to help extract the police. And last weekend, the Army issued their own report on the incident, and they cleared themselves of any responsibility. And so that is going to create tensions going forward. You know, there has to be better coordination between the security forces, and that's always been a problem in the Philippines. The real fallout, of course, remains the peace process. Senator Marcos, the son of the former dictator, has suspended hearings on the Bangsamoro Basic Law. Two of the 13 senators that originally sponsored the bill have removed their names. So a minority of the Senate actually supports the bill now. And the head of the House committee that is holding hearings on the bill has maintained an even harder line. He has refused to hold hearings until reports are filed from four different agencies and government departments, while another influential congressman has called for an independent inquiry to be held. And all of this is further complicated right now by the Department of Justice, which has just filed charges against 13 MILF and BIF members. So there's going to be real fallout from this. This is a bit of inside baseball, but the timetable is very tight for all this. Even if the Bangsamoro Basic Law is passed, this implementing legislation, and that's a big if right now, then they still have to hold a plebiscite and they have to establish a transitional government. And all of this has to be done before May 2016 when the current president's term expires, but also the existing autonomous government in Mindanao will expire and they can create this new legal entity in its place.
Dr. Abuza, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
And that was Zach Abuza. Finally, we turn to our one to watch. Hui Ten Bosch, a theme park modeled after the Netherlands in Japan's Nagasaki prefecture, has announced plans to open a hotel with robot staff and other advanced technologies in July 2015. The hotel will be called Henna Hotel, which translates as Strange Hotel. Operating under the motto, A Commitment for Evolution, the hotel will feature three actroids, robots with strong human likenesses, that will act as receptionists capable of holding intelligent conversations with guests, and plans to utilize other robots to clean and perform services. And that's it for the Cogitasia podcast for this week. Remember, you can always find more on cogitasia.com. And until then, we'll be back next week. I'm Colin Quinn. Thanks for listening.